You are listening to the Cycling Podcast in association with Rafa, celebrating the sport and producing the finest cycling clothing since 2004. Today, we're in Villars-les-Dombes, Parc des Oiseaux.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore. I'm with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
And Kaylee Fretz.
I forgot my theme tune once again. Shoot.
Oh, well. We're also going to be joined a little bit later by Daniel Freep, who's promised to pop over and join us. Let's kick off with what I hope will be a very brief tale of the attack.
Lionel. It will be, yeah, very brief. Stage 14 from Montélimar to Villars-les-Dombes, the Parc des Oiseaux, Bird Park. That's where we are right at this moment in the Bird Park. A pretty snoozy, slow day in the sun for most of the day. 208.5 kilometres. Four-man break. Martin Elminger of I Am Cycling, Jeremy Roy of Francis de Jure, Alex Howes of Cannondale Drapac, and Cesare Benedetti of Bora were away. The stage had started 15 minutes earlier than planned because of the headwind, and it was headwind most of the day, sometimes sidewind from either left or right, but a lot of headwind. Average speed for the first 3 hours was a leisurely 33.5 kilometres an hour. Those four riders never really got very far. With 50 kilometres to go, they had a minute and 29 advantage. 25 kilometres to go, that was down to 15 seconds. 14 kilometres to go, Howes was dropped. 9 kilometres to go, Benedetti was dropped. But the bunch made a real meal of catching them, or it was a deliberate meal, really. They held off catching. And the last two, that was Elminger and Roy, were caught inside 3.5 to go. And then it was the sprint finish, which Etix Quickstep took charge of. But Mark Cavendish got the better of Marcel Kittel. A little bit of controversy about the finish and whether Cavendish deviated from his line or impeded Kittel. We'll talk about that in the episode. Christoph was second, that's Alexander Christoph. Second, Peter Sagan third, and then the three Germans, Degenkolb, Kittel and Greipel, just behind. No change overall. Chris Froome still 147 up on Balcomolima. Peter Sagan still in green. Thomas De Gendt still in polka dots. Adam Yates still in white.
Yeah, Cavendish, four stage wins, 13 total.
Amazing.
I think most people will feel now that the Eddie Merckx record is not just possible, but perhaps even likely. Because he's not that old, Cavendish.
He's not. No. I mean, one more tour, right? At this point.
Well, at the rate he's going.
That's all he needs. That's what I'm saying. Yeah, he only needs to come to one more tour. And, and if he rides like he did this year, then he's got it.
So the Cannonball on 34 and the Cannonball on 30. Yeah, it's amazing, because before this tour, we thought that record was not on anymore. We had written it off. And we hadn't written Cavendish off, but he was so far behind in terms of the days of winning four or five stages looked to be behind him.
He was a fading force. He's come roaring back. This time last year, Andrew Greipel was a fading force. He won four stages last year and has been absolutely nowhere this year. It was his 34th birthday today. So I suspect that was Greipel's last hurrah last year. You never can tell. The margins are so small. And, you know, Cavendish got off to a great start this year, and you feel that he's carried that momentum through, and the balance could swing back towards Marcel Kittel next year.
Yeah, and there was a bit of controversy, however you guys want to say it. At the finish line, Kittel threw his arm up in the air as they were kind of coming across the line there. It looked like he got a little bit chopped, perhaps, by Cavendish. Kev said after the race that Kittel came up behind him and whacked him on the back, and he thought it was just a congratulations, but it might have been something else. We're not really sure.
Well, yeah, I mean, Kittel said that as they were sprinting, Cavendish moved to the right, but Kittel moved to the left also. Kittel says that they touched shoulders, and Kittel backed off and braked, and he said that the decision of the jury wasn't correct. The result wasn't overturned. Cavendish got the victory. I was at the Etix Quickstep bus just after Kittel had got back there, and Tom Steels, who's a he won four stages of one tour, I think 1998 or 99, one of those years.
Also disqualified 1 year for chucking his bead on at somebody during a finish sprint. Well worth looking up on YouTube.
He was indeed. So he knows a thing or two about sprinting and sprinting fairly, I guess. He said he didn't see it. Brian Holm also said that he didn't see it. And Wilfred Peters, who did see it, was filling them both in on what had happened. And Peters basically said that, yeah, Cavendish did move, but Kittel also moved. And when Cavendish moved, he was more or less past Kittel anyway. You know, the result was done. They were just a bit upset that it bumped Kittel down from second to fifth, I think it was. But Peter said that's sprinting, and he felt it was a fair sprint, and he wasn't expecting the jury to overturn it.
In my ever so humble opinion, I would have to agree with that. I mean, he didn't deviate all that much. Neither of them deviated all that much. It was just a coming together. It was sprinting, as they say.
I spoke to Roger Hammond as well, the Dimension Data sports director, and we'll hear from him in a second. But the key thing he said was he felt Cavendish had sprinted down the white line. When you look at the overhead, that's not quite what happened. I mean, Cavendish did definitely move one way, but Kittel moved the other. But shall we listen to Roger Hammond? They were delighted. Five stage wins for Dimension Data in this tour, four of them for Cavendish, and this is Roger Hammond. Afternoon, Roger. I'm good, thank you. Yeah, how are you? Another happy atmosphere outside the Dimension Data bus.
Yeah, not too bad, is it? Eh? No, yeah, we're all quite pleased. Yeah, really pleased. I mean, everyone's worked hard for it. And I think there was, I don't know really, I suppose it never really crossed our mind to think that we would actually sit up. But, you know, everyone's worked hard, continued to work hard since the first victory on day one. So I think today's just kind of a confirmation that we have been.
In week one, I was talking to you about how you use your riders, and you were talking about using horses for courses. But today we saw Daniel Tekle-Heimanot doing some work in the final 15 kilometres or so, and all hands to the pump, really, because no other teams particularly wanted to take it up, and the break was still away. It didn't look like they were going to survive, but somebody had to close it down.
Yeah, I mean, you noticed a change in use of people. It's pretty obvious why. I mean, we lost Mark Renshaw, so we're a man short in our lead out. So we've had to kind of bump everybody further back in the pecking order, you know, not pecking order, but the line. So, which meant we've had to use people that we wouldn't really have liked to have used given tomorrow. But, we tried to save Daniel as long as possible, but we knew, you know, it's all about reading the course. And the thing about today was, you know, just under 6K to go, there was a small, narrow road into crosswind. We knew that it was crucial to be in there. And so we put some resources about being there, and that's how we were able to save Bernie until the last 3K, and then we were back on track. Then we're back into where we needed to be to do what we needed to do.
And it was about getting Mark into the position that he wanted to be on, which was on Marcel Kittel's wheel, I guess.
Yeah, that's it. You know, our lead out is just dropping him off. I mean, it's that we're not gonna lie, not gonna make up stories. It's, you know, Quickstepper by far the fastest lead out train here. They left it late as well, which kind of played into our hands really, in that they came real strong real late. We just needed to make sure we were there and ready for them to do it, and that's exactly what happened.
You weren't at all nervous about the little move Mark made as he came past Kittel, just slightly moved over to the right-hand side?
Well, I don't think we've looked at it a few times. You only had broken up TV, but I'm not too worried about it, because, I mean, Mark actually follows the white lines down the middle of the road. So I think it's more Marcel sort of puts his head down as Mark comes round him, as, you know, he's kind of looks a little bit dejectedly at the ground and drifts. He even drifts left a bit more than Mark drifts right, really. So, I'm not too nervous about it. I think if it... You know, Mark wouldn't want to win in a dodgy sprint anyway. You know, he's been, you know, he was in the receiving end of a nice sprint by Greipel last year, where Greipel not left the door open, but didn't deliberately close it. So, you know, I think he wouldn't have wanted to win it like that. And I think if you look at the aerial shot, he was way past it. He'd already put a bike length into him, really, by the time Marcel had even started looking to wave his arm. So I think it was, as far as I'm concerned, it was a pretty fair sprint.
And lastly, what can you tell me about how far through the tour Mark will go now? Will he go all the way to Paris, do you think? Is that how it's looking?
Well, I mean, look, he's still winning stages. I mean, why not? It's, the only thing we've been asked this since, I guess it's since somebody that's nothing to do with the team has put out a statement that he might not be going to the Paris. And, you know, there's not been any word from our team about it at all. So, you know, we're focusing on Mark trying to get to Paris. I mean, there's Champs-Élysées. He's, at the moment, I think he's sprinting the fastest guy in the peloton. So, have a look at tomorrow's stage. That's, I've got more worries about that than Mark, winning another stage in Champs-Élysées. I'm more worried about tomorrow's mountain stage. It looks nasty.
Well, you must be getting through that Niederberg wine, so I'll let you get on with it.
Yeah, looking forward to it. They sent us loads of champagne down. They must have known more than us, because they sent loads of champagne.
Look who it is, Lionel. We've been joined by occasional friend of the podcast. We've been joined by our good friend and colleague, Daniel Freeb. Hello, Daniel.
Erstwhile friend. once friend of the podcast, no longer friend. Hi.
Not a paid up friend, that's for sure.
Actually, feeling more kindly disposed towards you guys today because you got my contact lenses and my clothes.
Finally, no more mention of contact lenses or clothes. It's only a matter of time till you lose them, of course. Daniel, we've just watched Mark Cavendish win his fourth stage of this year's tour, 30th in total. He had Kittel in his pocket there, didn't he?
Well, he did, and of course the talking point of the day was Marcel Kittel complaining about the Cavendish changing his line. I've only seen the sprint once because I was at the finish line watching it on the Cannondale bus TV and then had to rush out and do interviews. However, the interesting thing for me is how Cavendish has really turned around the psychological battle, and I think we all are quite well aware of how much that had been, or up until this tour, how much that has been on Cavendish's mind. The Kittel superiority, the fact that Cavendish has never beaten him, I mean, I can sort of vouch for that. I know how difficult it's been sometimes to broach the subject of Marcel Kittel, of the German Übermensch, as Brian Holm likes to call him, and Brian Holm being Cavendish's former director of sportif. Now, Kittel's director of sportif, and I think Brian used to goad Cavendish a little bit with that call, Kittel the Übermensch, and refers to the fact that Kittel was taller, possibly better looking than Mark, not sure. Maybe we should run a poll on that.
We should do a Twitter poll. It's been mentioned a few times, hasn't it?
Yes. I think Brian used to poke Cav with that. Mark occasionally rose to the provocation. Anyway, he's really turned it around, and I never really believed that he was going to do that before this Tour de France. You know, it's getting a bit like it used to be in 2008, 2009. You sort of run out of things to say about Cavendish's sprint wins after three or four of them. But, you know, we have said it all before in this Tour, the track legs, the track training that he's been doing. He's got his jump back. The key thing with beating, as far as beating Kittel is concerned, is being able to sort of drop him in the first five or six or ten pedal strokes. And Cavendish had never been able to do that until this Tour de France, and he can do that now because he's got that jump back.
Well, he gave an interesting press conference, Mark. He was asked again about the work he's been doing on the track and whether that's made the difference, and he said, well, it's not, it has made the difference, but it's not the way that people think. It's not leg speed, it's not strength. He said it's more racing noose. It's more his ability to judge when to go. I mean, he played a blinder in every sprint he's won. He's found the right wheel, he's done the right thing, he's gone at the right time. And he did that again today, and that was interesting. He said he's been able to exercise a bit more patience.
Yeah, and I think we've talked about it before, how perhaps having a big train over the last few years has blunted some of that innate racing instinct, which was always one of Cavendish's great strengths. And, you know, I've referred before to his debut season 2007 and how fantastically he sprinted that year without any kind of train. You know, we saw it a few days ago when Dimension Data really messed up their sprint train and it didn't really affect Cav, and they got a bit of a telling off from Rolf Aldag. Understand that they went through that really in forensic detail, the sprint that Cavendish won, the third sprint that he won, and where the team had gone wrong, and they really corrected that today. And they also took control today, which they hadn't done thus far. They'd left it pretty late and come forward with two or three men prior to today, and today they really took it on and bossed it.
Anything else to report, Daniel, from the tour? I mean, is it over?
No, not yet.
Froome took exception to the suggestion that he's already won it tonight.
No, he hasn't already won it, has he? No, he hasn't already won it. Three big Alpine.
Sorry, I'm a week early. Apologies, I got my dates mixed up.
Yeah, it's not Paris tomorrow, is it? It's chicken night tonight, and then it's heading towards Switzerland tomorrow.
Might join you for some chicken later, Lionel.
Chicken tonight, chocolate tomorrow. Daniel, see you later. Bye. He's turning into Chiro, isn't he? He's sprinting off.
Eurosport, the home of cycling.
And now, Pédaleur du Charme.
Thank you very much to Eurosport for sponsoring the cycling podcast and sponsoring our daily Pédaleur du Charme award. I had a brief stint on Eurosport today. Thanks very much to Carlton Kirby for having me on, and to Sean Kelly for popping out to get some coffees while I was on air. That was fun. I'll hopefully do it again, maybe someday. But yeah, thank you to Eurosport. And we got Mark Cavendish, his Pédaleur du Charme t-shirt this morning. Obviously a lucky omen because he won the stage wearing it underneath, I'm led to believe.
As a base layer?
Yep, it's very clever. Good wicking material. So that was splendid. Who are we going to give Pédaleur du Charme to today? There's a few contenders. I actually said who I think should be Pedal de Charme, and he was nominated by several people. Jeremy Roy, who's just lost his team leader, Thibaut Pinot, put a good show in today. He's quite an interesting bloke, Jeremy Roy. He's a good breakaway rider. Kaylee, I think you poo-pooed that idea when I mentioned it.
I did poo-poo that idea. Just like last time I was on, or maybe two times ago, I would put my hand in the air for Alex Howes once again. He was in his third breakaway of the tour today. He always has a great attitude. There was a fantastic line at the end. I caught up on the finish line. He said, "It's probably better to shoot yourself in the foot than to just sit around and wait to get your legs ripped off by Mark Cavendish," which I thought was a good attitude. Might as well give it a go, and I would nominate
Alex
him for Pedaleur
de Charme. Alex Howes, of course, features in our Kilometer Zero book club. He started a professional writer's book club a few years ago. It lasted for one meeting. As I said to him, that's quite similar to a lot of book clubs, I think.
Just on their breakaway, the four riders, I spoke to Martin Elmiger of I Am Cycling after the line. He was one of the last men standing with Jeremy Roy, and Elmiger tried a little move, didn't he, to try and get rid of Roy, but that was never going to work either. I mean, I said, did you feel there was ever a moment that this break was going to stay away? And he said, no. He made no bones about that, and that was pretty obvious. But he did also say that Alex Howes and Benedetti weren't really able to contribute very much at all from, say, 40 kilometres to go. It was really just the other two. So charming pedalling, but perhaps not very strong pedalling by Alex Howes today.
Well, there are three of us here, so let's do a vote. Hands up for Alex Howes. Well, I get two votes, so okay.
That's pretty much how the cycling podcast works, isn't it? You get two votes, yeah.
Alex Howes it is then, so I will go.
Victory
need to celebrate
for the Americans, so I'm going to celebrate all I want over here.
Could be our first American winner.
Really?
You had a little, I think so, you had a little bit of news on Pierre Roland at Cannondale.
Yeah, so this is another little tidbit. So Pierre Roland obviously had a bad crash, basically, as soon as they hit the mountains, and it turns out that he may have a broken hand, does not want to go.
He hit a wall, didn't he, on the stage on the descent into Luchon.
And again, this is unconfirmed by a team doctor, but this is from a teammate. He may have a broken hand, but does not want to get it x-rayed because he doesn't want to know, which I think is brave or stupid or crazy. Mm. I'm not really sure, but he wants to keep riding.
I can totally get that. If you had a broken hand and you knew about it, that's much worse than thinking, oh, it might be okay and it will heal up.
Mm-hmm. Mm. And apparently it doesn't look great, is what I was told. So, to this day, which is, well, we're now many stages past the actual crash, so maybe go see a doc.
You are listening to the Cycling Podcast in association with Rafa. Whoever you are, wherever you ride, whatever the reason, Rafa exists to improve your ride with the finest kit, inspiring stories, and vibrant clubhouses and communities all over the world. See rafa.cc for more information.
Thank you very much to our sponsor, Rafa. Kaylee, are you wearing any Rafa today?
I have my stripy Rafa socks on.
Nice.
But that's it.
I've got the Rafa trousers on now. Thank you very much to Rafa. Fantastic partners to the Cycling Podcast. And I mention every day they're more than a race series. They're every day publishing a story on their website, rafa.cc, more than a race. Some kind of sideways look at the tour and things around the tour. Today's is actually a little interview with Ian Boswell, a friend of the podcast, Ian Boswell, featured in our friend special earlier this year, Young Americans. And he's back in the US having a little break, having ridden the Giro. He says he might ride the Vuelta.
Just in my home state, actually.
Yeah.
Back in Vermont.
Yeah. And he could ride the Vuelta or perhaps the Tour of Britain. But while he's taking a little break, he is chopping down trees, making logs for bowling, played some golf. I don't know if Team Sky realized all this.
This is
and moving chickens. What does that mean?
Well, chickens need to be moved. You have to move chickens because
you're a chicken owner.
They scratch up a part of the grass or the dirt, and then once it's all turned to dirt, you have to then move them. So they've got.
I hope Ian's listening to the podcast as well. He says he's following the tour. I hope that.
Do chickens actually have to be moved?
Yeah.
You were joking.
Periodically, yeah. Oh. Otherwise, they're just in dust or. You know, they want to.
They've sad chickens.
They like nice, fresh ground every
Speaking
so often.
Speaking of chickens.
Anyway. Oh, yeah. Well, it's, as we said with Daniel, we may meet up for the best chicken in France, in Bourg-en-Bresse. In the world, yeah. The town that's best known for its chicken. We started off in Montélimar this morning, the home of nougat, or nugget, depending on how people say it. A lot of debate about that, isn't there? The sweet, nutty snack. Did you? You had some nougat,
I bought some nougat in the petrol station.
I don't really like it.
No, I don't like it. It's quite gooey.
I had some nougat nugget flavored ice cream at the finish line today. That was delicious. Yeah.
I think you're in Bourg-en-Bresse tonight as well, Kaylee, aren't you?
Hopefully
you and Andy Hood are going to maybe join us for dinner.
I think we're going to try to join you because I've never had the world's best chicken. I missed out 2 years ago.
Yeah, it's in a cream sauce with girolle mushrooms and it's, it goes...
let's get this thing finished so that we can get
on.
There.
Let's go.
We do want to chat a little bit about the overall thing. Not much happened or nothing happened today. Tomorrow's a very interesting stage, really, having studied it properly now. I dismissed it earlier, but very interesting stage. And Chris Froome, who's still leading the race, did say that it was one that they'd really identified as a potentially, you know, dangerous proposition. Kaylee, you were speaking to some people, I think, at the start of today or the last couple of days. Some of the directors on teams, we had a couple of them in the podcast last night, Marc Sergent and Valerio Piva, both agreeing with the decision that was taken on Mont Ventoux to take the time at the kilometre to go. But there are a few people out there who are not happy and don't think it was the right decision.
Yeah, well I think the most... the biggest name would be the Badger, would be Bernardino, has sort of come out and said...
Well, there's a shock.
has come out and said that, you know... things happen in bike racing and the time should be taken as you cross the finish line. But there are some others as well. They're all sort of off the record informal conversations, so I won't name any names. But there are a couple sort of more old school directors that that believe that, like I just said, bike racing is bike racing and things happen in bike racing. And you know, we have other examples that are not directly, not exactly the same, but similar. I mean, things like train crossings and things like that where, you know, completely out of the control of a rider or even an organizer, and yet they become part of the bike race.
Andy Hood in Velo News has written a piece today. He's somebody who's spoken on the record is Eusebio Unzue, the main man at Movistar. It's been around for years, you know, since the Reynolds team back in the 80s, then Banesto. Now the team is Movistar. And you'd expect him to be unhappy, perhaps, with the decision, because it's not so much that it penalised his riders, Nairo Quintana and Alejandro Valverde, but more that it kind of benefited Froome in a way. But actually, the point he made was actually quite a valid one, I thought, that it's not so much this particular incident, it's more the precedent that it sets, because how do you determine what is an exceptional incident? You know, we've had two this year, the collapsing kilometre to go arch. We don't want races to be subject to these sorts of things too often. I think it confuses the picture massively, and I thought that Unzue made a couple of valid points in his short interview with Andy.
I absolutely agree. There are other things that can happen. We had the Yates issue with the falling banner, and we have, like I said, train crossings and things like that. If the rule is just get yourself across the line and that's the time we give you, that's a very simple rule to enforce. And when we start backing things up, it is much more difficult to then apply the rules. This is a perfect example. The UCI rule book does not actually provide for the result that was handed out. It says in exceptional circumstances, and it lists, I think it's like five or six different things that the jury and the race organizer can do. None of those things is pick the time at the point of the incident. None of those things. So they essentially the jury just made up a new option.
But the precedent had been set with the Adam Yates.
Right.
And, I mean, we've been talking informally, and this is total speculation, but ASO and UCI were in a really difficult position because... really, Team Sky and Dave Brailsford and Chris Froome, they were the wronged party. And I'm sure if there were discussions after the finish about what they were going to do, because Dave Brailsford came out and was very, very even-handed about it, and obviously the result went their way. They couldn't really have hoped for any better from that. But can you imagine where we would be with the race now if they'd come to a different conclusion. I mean, Sky would feel really wronged at this point.
Although Froome would still be in yellow.
Yeah, well, and I think a lot of Sky fans would feel really wronged. I think a lot of cycling fans would feel very wronged that like the race had been very dramatically changed by something that wasn't actually bike racing. I don't think that there's really a right answer to this. There's a whole bunch of somewhat wrong answers. I actually do think that they picked the least wrong of all of the answers. I don't think that taking time at the finish line would have been the right way to do it. But there is that argument, the sort of bike racing happens and things happen in bike racing argument can be compelling.
You're absolutely right there, Kayleigh, and I do envy the certainty that some people have about these things when there clearly isn't a right answer.
Yeah, there's
also a theory out there that, you know, that somehow the fact that it was Team Sky had a bearing on the decision that was taken. I think, as you say, Lionel, the case with Adam
Do people
Yates,
know that it's run by the French?
Well, there is that, but there's also a rumour, an assumption that the UCI, who are of course led by Brian Cookson, a Brit, former head of British Cycling, that the UCI and Team Sky are very close. I think anybody who has any insight at all into the relationship between Brian Cookson and Dave Brailsford would nonsense that, because they're not particularly close.
No, and the president of the UCI doesn't have any direct influence in any of these decisions. These decisions are made by the UCI commissaires on the ground, and I'd be really, really surprised if there was any influence brought to bear in the short window of opportunity. They must have been studying the telemetry and the video over and over and over again to come to the best possible outcome that
the
was
least
fairest,
worst outcome.
Yeah, which was fairest to the most riders. And obviously, in those circumstances, Malcolm Olimer is the big name rider who kind of lost out. He drew the shortest straw, but again, the only alternative that I think there could have been is just to annul the GC results completely from that day and say that the Mont Ventoux stage didn't count. But then you've got riders who lost 2, 3, 4 minutes on Mont Ventoux.
Then you have the guys
were not affected by that crash at all.
Yeah, battling for 8th, 9th, 10th.
Suddenly back in the race. And so that wouldn't have been ideal either. And so I think they, you know, we kind of got to draw a line under it and move on. But
I do have one more. You mentioned telemetry there, and actually this made the decision more difficult, is the, I think they're the dimension data little things in the back of the saddles. Apparently those were not really working properly that particular stage, and that was definitely relevant in not being able to, for example, take the time at some other point. I think the fact that those weren't working may have skewed the way that they interpreted the rules.
I think, Rich, you made that point there, saying you envy people their certainty. I do as well, and I think there's a temptation. Temptation to say, "Oh well, they've got this data, and therefore it must be really easy to just look at the data." But we don't know how accurate and how reliable that data is on any given day. We're not yet at a point where you can just run the entire bike race on the data that's coming off those little things sticking out from the back of the saddle.
Oh, look at this. It's Seb Piquet. Hello, Seb.
Hello, how are you?
How are you?
I'm fine. I'm fine stage.
A pretty boring day for you in the race radio car?
Not at all. I had an 8-minute siesta, but shh, don't tell anyone.
Well, Seb, there's lots to talk about. Maybe you can join us tomorrow, can you, properly, rather than this brief cameo?
In kilos, absolutely.
Look forward to
see
it.
Then.
See you then.
Has he started early today.
Listen... We want to get him on.
We want to get him on tomorrow.
He's going to be listening to this. He's going to be upset.
He was stalking for about 45 seconds around behind you guys.
I didn't see him. I was checking my phone for something related to something.
Well, he stopped when you guys turned around like a panther.
Like grandmother's footsteps. Is it that game? Like when you turn around, he stops dead.
Enough of this nonsense, chaps. I thought it was interesting in the post-stage interview today, Chris Froome was talking about, you know, who he's worried about. He said Valverde, interestingly, and Movistar, and BMC, and Mollema, obviously. The one person he didn't mention was Adam Yates at all. I grabbed Matt White, the sports director at Orica Bike Exchange.
Orica Bike Edge. I'm just going with that now. That's it.
Orica Bike Exchange at the finish. Just to find out, you know, how... Matt White was really in his element at the Giro with Esteban Chavez challenging for the overall. I wondered how the experience here compared to that. Matt, you seem to really enjoy being in the heat of the GC battle at the Giro with another young, promising young rider. Does this feel kind of similar?
Well, so far so good, isn't it? It certainly wasn't expected to be in this position so late in the race. And we've got three very big mountain stages to come. Today was just a day to keep out of trouble and save a bit of energy. We're going to be a brutal day tomorrow.
How is Adam coping with it, with some of the pressure, the tension that's come his way?
I don't think there's any pressure, because only the pressure that he puts on himself. Obviously, he wants to do the best result he can. We're still looking for a stage win, and if we're still looking for stage wins in these mountain stages, we're going to be finishing in a nice place in general classification. He's handled the media attention, everything that goes with wearing the white jersey very, very well.
He's a very different character to Esteban Chavez, isn't he?
He is, and he's a very different character than what he was 12 months ago as well. And I suppose that comes with maturity and experience.
One of the things he's talked about was signing up when he joined Orica at the same time as Chavez, I think. They all signed up to a long-term plan for this team to support them in stage races like this. Can you honestly say that this was the sort of vision that you had back then, and that was the way that you wanted the team to sort of evolve? Because it was a very different type of team with very different priorities just a few years ago.
It was, but we wanted to develop our own talent. So both Yates brothers and Esteban started their careers with us, and that takes time. And honestly, they have surprised me how quick they have developed, because cycling's changed. Esteban obviously is a couple of years older, so his development is less of a surprise, because he's 26, so he's got 3 years older than those guys. But the development he's had since he came back from injury has been incredible. And then both Adam and Simon, what they did in their first 2 years as professionals, Adam nearly won San Sebastian as a Neo Pro, won it the second year round, and even their first rides in the Tour de France, both of them, to be so competitive against the best guys in the world, it's been a great experience, and it's very exciting.
Those guys are young and learning, obviously. I guess for the team as well, you'll be learning a lot about how to support a GC rider in a race like this.
Exactly, and we've had time over the last two or three years to build a team around them. We've got some guys that are ready to step up, for example, for next year's Tour de France, and we've got our eyes on one or two guys to really bolster their goals for next year as well.
I mean, he keeps on about stage win. A stage win is a priority, but he's third after the time trial. I think a lot of people suspect him to drop away in the time trial. Can you honestly say that a stage win is still a priority over a podium finish?
Oh, we would love to finish on the podium. Everyone who's in around the mark there in that first 10 places is really aiming for that podium, for sure. He did the best time trial of his life yesterday. On a time trial course, it certainly didn't suit his characteristics. At the moment, obviously, we want to keep the white jersey. And by doing that, we want to be mixing it in the mountain stages. And whatever the result is at the end, it's been a great experience, and he's going to give it 100%.
Look at this, Rich. Oh,
Monsieur.
A local wine.
What is this you're bringing us?
This is a wine called Cerdon.
Lovely. Pink and fizzy.
Produced in the area.
We're contractually obliged to only drink South African Niederberg wine, but we'll make an exception.
You're going to taste?
We're
going
we are.
Going to something like champagne, but
beautiful.
This is fresh.
Cheers. Mm. Oh, lovely.
Very light.
Lovely, yeah. a lovely light wine.
It's delicious. Perfect for a summer's evening. Well, thank you very much for keeping the cycling podcast refreshed. Appreciate
you
it.
Want more when you have
okay, thank you very much. What a kind man.
It's something good.
Lovely. Bit of.
Listen, we heard there from Matt White. Any other business before finishing up?
One little quirk from today's breakaway is that Martin Elmiger and Jeremy Waugh were next to each other in general classification, 70th and 71st. I thought that was quite interesting. That caught my eye while they were up the road racing. And also the big two that are next to each other overall. We've been talking about Movistar. Nairo Quintana fourth, Alejandro Valverde fifth overall, but the big battle at Movistar surely has to be between Jon Izagirre and Gorka Izagirre, brothers in the Movistar team. They are 74th and 75th overall, only 11 seconds split them. I'm going to actually look back and work out where Jon took those 11 seconds from Gorka in the race. I'm going to follow that one all the way to Paris and see who wins the battle of the brothers.
I tipped Jon to finish in the top 10 here.
That must have been in the time trial or something, right? I mean, they can't ride next to each other in the time trial.
Of course,
one would think so. Right, listen, the other day when we released our Kilometre Zero about cycling fashion, which had an interview with Paul Smith, we offered a copy of his book, Paul Smith's Cycling Scrapbook, if you nominated your favourite cycling jersey and explain why. Lots of entries, lots of nominations for Brooklyn, a 70s jersey, and lots of...
the one that looks like the American flag, isn't it? Yep, it was a chewing gum Kayleigh's manufacturer. Favorite. Yeah, with the stars and stripes.
A few nominations for the Swiss National Champions jersey. Agree with that. The one that Fabian Cancellara often sports.
That's red with a white cross in the middle. Yeah.
Yes, thanks, Lionel.
Well, people aren't able to... They can't imagine what these... I have to paint pictures with words for them, listeners.
Okay. a lot of nominations for my personal favorite, Laviclair.
Laviclair is the Mondrian-inspired one, patchwork of square colours, red, yellow, blue, grey.
Okay, I was going to run through a few more, but maybe I won't. The winner, and I'm going to find, because I had a couple more that I can't actually just locate at the moment, so I'm going to look them out. But the winner, I think, is a guy called Charlie Battersby, who nominates a jersey that doesn't belong to a trade team or a national team. It's the Freddie Merckx flower jersey, designed by a group of guys from Belgium that go under the name of Pedal Harder. Limited edition kit, like everything cycling related from Belgium, the styling of the kit is super cool, black with pink flowers on the shoulders, arms and sides, Freddie Merckx emblazoned across the chest, and references to Freddie Mercury and to the 80-20 rule on the back. 80% attitude, 20% pedaling. Team it with some pink socks and you're ready to go. Says Charlie, I've been stared at, pointed at and called Laura Ashley on wheels by my girlfriend, but I don't care. It gives me quiet confidence when I ride, and the knowledge that it's all about the style and not the speed. I hope Sir Paul would agree.
Have you got a picture of this jersey? Have you seen it?
Yeah, there it is.
Can you paint a picture with words for us, Lionel?
I can't. It's not loading, is it? Richard's phone here. This is... I mean, good job this isn't live, really, isn't it?
Cut out some of the waffle.
Here we are. No, keep the waffle in. People will be loving this waffle. Here we are. Oh, wow, look at that. Yeah, so it's black with a kind of... It is Laura Ashley print. Floral print, pink and pink flowers and green leaves down the side and down the arms. Beautiful. Mm. Beautiful. I can see myself
wearing a stripe that kind of goes down the side and then down the leg, all continuous.
Wow. Congratulations, Charlie. You win a copy of Paul Smith's cycling scrapbook. Hope you enjoy that. You won't find a picture of that jersey in there, I'm afraid. We should wrap things up for tonight. We've got to get to Bourg-en-Bresse. Those chickens are not going to...
Must be moved.
They're not going to pan fry themselves.
They're not going to be eating
deliciously
themselves,
are they?
okay, enough. Kayleigh Fretz, thank you very much. Hopefully you'll join us again for the end of the tour.
Always lovely to be here.
Thank you, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.